Hello, Happy New Year. I'm Michelle Henratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Dockage that provides high quality continuing professional development for GOC registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, dockage.info. This episode is all about vitreomacular interface disorders, following on from the Docket webinar presented by ophthalmologist Mr. Cam Balaghan. Cam is a consultant in cataract and vitreoretinal surgery at Wolverhampton Eye Infirmary. He also has a private practice based in the West Midlands. Cam is keen to help optometrists like you and me understand vitreomacular conditions better, as we serve as the first line of defence for patients in the community. We know that vitreoretinal problems can arise as a natural part of ageing, but in some patients, could something more sinister be at play? Many of us now have OCT technology readily available in practice, and while the scans can help us identify potential vitreomacular problems more easily, they may also pick up on normal variations in the eye which aren't causing the patient any problems at all. Being able to differentiate between conditions that are sight-threatening and require urgent referral and those that aren't makes a huge difference, both to the success of patient outcomes and the efficiency of already stretched hospital eye services. That's why in his recent webinar, Cam gave us an in-depth overview of the vitreomacular conditions that we might commonly encounter in everyday practice, such as adhesion, traction and epiretinal membranes. If you haven't already watched the session, you can find it on the Dockett's website. There's also a link in the podcast description. On this podcast, Cam will take us through the key stages to look out for if a patient is at risk of eventually developing a full thickness macular hole. So let's get started. Cam is here with me now. Cam, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Michelle. Lovely to be with you again. Thank you.
So that was a fantastic webinar that you delivered recently for Dockett. And this podcast is going to be picking up on some of the questions that were asked during that webinar that we didn't have time to cover at the end. So I just want to take us back to the beginning of the webinar, though, where we started talking about the natural aging process of the vitreous. And that can sometimes lead to the pathology that causes a macular hole. But just before we get to that, we do have a couple of listener questions about floaters, because we do get those quite a lot in practice. If they are not the red flag signs of a retinal detachment, can they be treated?
Yes, absolutely. But most people tend to neuroadapt. So the critical thing here is deciding, first of all, are the floaters acute or chronic? If they're acute, you do need to exclude retinal tears and retinal detachments. But failing that, if the symptoms of floaters are chronic, so this may be in a patient who doesn't have a PVD, so just natural vitreous degeneration and synaresis, or if they've developed a PVD as well and can't get accustomed to the new floaters they have, and if they've had at least 4 to 6 months and still cannot adapt to them, if they're still really annoying them, affecting their quality of life, and if they're generally over, 45 or so, then they're generally very good candidates for having treatment. And the most commonly performed and most effective treatment for that is that of vitrectomy if they're willing to accept the very small risks of surgery. A modern vitrectomy now has a safety profile equivalent to, or maybe even slightly better than, that of modern cataract surgery in terms of its risks of severe complications like endophthalmitis or retinal detachment. Myself, I've operated on probably over 100 patients just for floaters alone, and they're generally some of my happiest patients. So never write them off. That's the key thing. Always consider it and offer them that.
So what is the threshold for referral into the NHS for something like this? Because we are aware that units are under a lot of pressure. So is it worth referring via the NHS, knowing that the patient may have to wait a long time to be seen, or is it worth trying to pursue a private referral for something like floaters?
It's not something that I sense is widely available on the NHS due to resource restraints, but it's always available privately because we don't have those constraints. As you know, there are limitations in terms of what can be offered on the NHS in terms of local guidelines. If they have floaters that are severely obscuring the retina and there's needs to monitor the retina, for example, in a diabetic, if they have very severe floaters or asteroid, etc., then again, that could usually be pushed forward on medical grounds. It's very much dependent on local practices and what the local ICBs are willing to fund.
So let's just move on now. So we've talked about floaters, but the next thing that you moved on to in terms of the webinar is we talked about the vitreomacular interface. And there are cases where the vitreous doesn't detach completely and you get adhesion to the retina. What are the factors that tend to affect whether or not that vitreous detaches cleanly or whether or not it does actually adhere and cause a potential problem?
So assuming that there aren't any medical causes for strong vitreomacular traction, you know, if a patient's got epiretinal membranes, previous history of uveitis, and other conditions that may result in abnormal adhesion, generally it boils down to your genetics and how your eye was made.
And where the vitreous is adhering, do we need to monitor that more carefully, or can we just leave the patient to report if they develop symptoms?
Yes, so vitreomacular adhesion is normal. So that's where the vitreous is still attached to the fovea, but separated in the perifoveal region. That's a normal part of PVD evolution going from stages 1 to 4 in the classical staging system. So that doesn't need monitoring, but a very small fraction of those patients will develop traction. So these are those patients that are destined to have very significant adhesion in the vitrofoveal region. So those are the patients where, if they develop traction, they may or may not have symptoms. And those are the ones that we'd monitor. Remember, prior to the advent of OCT, PVDs were always evolving. If, however, you find that there's definite traction, which is a change in the contour of the fovea in the presence of attachment, and you can clearly see that there's anteroposterior traction occurring from the vitreous at the level of the fovea, then those are the patients that certainly should be given an AMSA chart and advised to monitor for worsening.
But what if the symptoms do appear to get worse, or if the patient becomes symptomatic?
If they have symptoms and the symptoms are affecting them, then they should be referred to your local hospital vitreoretinal department. And if they don't have symptoms, then generally in the hospital, we're not going to treat them. We'll treat them when they become symptomatic. So those are the patients where you would, again, give an AMSA chart and say, come back if it becomes symptomatic. I think it's very reasonable to see that patient again in, say, 3 to 4 months in your practice, if the practice allows, repeat the OCT scan, look for any changes that would prompt referral. So that would be A, the development of symptoms, B, worsening of the traction, or C, the development of a full thickness macular hole.
Mm. And I think optometrists are sort of thinking around, you know, how can we best monitor patients? How can we best pick up when the symptoms are significant? Mm-hmm. And so where the vitreous is still partially attached, one listener did actually ask, is it possible for patients with just adhesion to experience distortion without traction? And is that something that they need to be worried about?
So generally, no. The symptoms of distortion come from there being an abnormality with that foveal region. So you could have just vitreomacular adhesion, i.e. no traction on the retina, but the distortion could be for other reasons.
Mm.
Right. So you do need to do a good fundoscopic examination, look for signs of CSR, AMD, other maculopathies, DMO, it's CMO, etc.
If a patient does have persistent traction, so you know that they've been reporting this for a while and have been self-monitoring, but they are very troubled by it, is it worth referring those patients for potential treatment to have that traction resolved?
Very good question, Michelle. So our indications to treat these patients is based on symptomatology in the context of vitreomacular traction. The premise with a lot of these vitreomacular surgical conditions like epiretinal membranes, the mellar holes, vitreomacular traction, is that the OCTs are generally useful in the diagnosis and monitoring. But as you know, some people can have minor changes on OCT but significant symptoms, and other patients can have significant changes on OCT with minimal symptoms. Ultimately, we are guided more by the symptomatology. So if the patient has minor symptoms only, then the risks of surgery are probably not outweighed by the benefits. And the opposite is true if they have significant symptoms. So if they have VMT, significant symptoms, it's affecting their quality of life, they accept the risks and benefits, the small risks of surgery, then we would offer surgery as long as the patient knows that no surgery is risk-free, but the safety profile of modern vitreoretinal surgery is very good.
And an optometrist did actually ask, is ochroplasmin still used as a treatment for VMT?
It was really in favour about 10 years ago, based on some good randomised clinical studies. However, real-world practice has strongly suggested that it doesn't seem to work as effectively as we used to think it did. And that was certainly my experience. So ochroplasmin is an enzyme which works by dissolving the molecular bonds between the vitreous and the inner limiting membrane. So the idea is you use an enzyme to dissolve and weaken those adhesions to allow accelerated separation of the vitreous from the fovea. And the aim there would be to treat symptomatic vitreomacular traction or generally small full-thickness macular holes with vitreomacular traction. And what the real-world experience showed is that the rates of spontaneous separation and release of vitreomacular traction wasn't as high as suggested, and also that many patients did experience some side effects from the treatment, albeit transient. I certainly had patients that lost a significant amount of vision transiently in the initial phases after the injection, which then resolved. And there are other options, A, surgery, B, just injecting gas into the vitreous cavity, something called pneumatic vitreolysis, could also be used as an alternative and significantly cheaper as well.
Just moving on through the stages a bit more. So does vitreomacular traction usually progress to a lamellar hole? So if the vitre doesn't attach cleanly, is it more likely that a patient will develop a lamellar hole?
So many of these vitreomacular traction cases remain stable. But as we've all seen, the options for when it does separate are that it can create a lamellar defect. And most of those are usually stable and don't need referral or monitoring. If they do develop a lamellar hole, if they do progress, if the vision continues to deteriorate, if they still have symptoms, then those are the ones that we would now see in clinic. And in terms of lamellar holes, there are now more features that we are able to identify with lamellar hole pathology that differentiates lamellar holes into different categories that allow us to now offer surgery. And we are offering surgery more now in this context than we used to for both tractional lamellar holes, where you can see conceptually by relieving the traction, we would improve potentially the OCT appearances and symptoms, but also in degenerative lamellar holes, where specialized modification of surgery could potentially result in stabilization and some improvement in vision.
Because, of course, there is a risk that that lamellar hole can progress to a full thickness macular hole. So if you do identify a lamellar hole on your eye examination, is it something that you should be monitoring on a regular basis? Or again, is it up to the patient to self-monitor as again?
Self-monitoring is always important for all of these conditions. You know, give them an AMSA chart. If they have a lamellar hole, look back at previous scans. If you've got them in your practice, has it been there for a long time? Is it changing? Does the patient have any symptoms? And if the answer is no to all of the above, then I wouldn't necessarily monitor them any more than you would during normal routine examination, because if the patient can be relied to self-monitor, then that is what we will use to offer surgery. Mm. And therefore, that's what you would use as a referral criterion.
And just moving on to where a full thickness macular hole develops, what are the risk factors for these developing?
So with full thickness macular holes, the risk factors are obviously vitreomacular traction. That's the key risk factor. It tends to be more common with age, more common in ladies. Myopia is also a risk factor. Presence of a macular hole in the other eye is a strong risk factor. Depending on the epidemiology studies you read, you know, approximately a 10 to 15% chance that you have a macular hole in one eye, you'll develop it in the other, or have vitreomacular traction in the other. Those are the key risk factors that we should be aware of for full thickness macular holes.
So in the lecture, you did use OCT images to show us the difference between a lamellar hole and a full thickness macular hole. So OCT has really helped us with that. Yeah. But where practices don't have OCT, how can they detect macular hole without using an OCT? Mm. Because that was something you did cover in the lecture, and I think it is worth repeating on the podcast.
I'm a big believer in going back to basics, which is very good clinical examination in a dilated fundus. Remember, OCT has only been around for 20 years, and we've been offering surgery for macular holes well before the development of OCT. So how did we tell the difference between full-thickness macular holes, lamellar holes, which classically we didn't operate on, and medical macular conditions such as AMD, CSR? That is down to good clinical examination and pattern recognition. And again, I do urge listeners to go back to the slides that are on your website to have a look at that in your own time. But it's pattern recognition. You know, macular holes don't look anything like wet AMD, for example. In the context of DMO or CMO, you won't see a hole. The key thing here is how do you differentiate full-thickness macular holes from, say, a pseudo-hole or from a lamellar hole? And if you remember from the lecture, I said that in a full-thickness macular hole, you have now lost photoreceptors and the outer retina in the very, very center, unlike a lamellar hole and unlike a pseudo-hole. So if we were to shine a thin light beam vertically or horizontally and ask the patient to fixate on that, then in the presence of a full thickness defect where there aren't any photoreceptors in the foveola in the very, very center, then if it's a thin light beam, a patient will experience either a gap or thinning. And that's called the Watzke-Allen test. In the context of a pseudo-hole where there's no loss of retinal tissue, so the foveal photoreceptors are still there, or lamellar hole where they're essentially still there and functioning, then the patient doesn't experience a break in the line or thinning. And that's how we used to tell the difference. So those skills are still really, really important to have, especially if you don't have OCT. The problem with technology, it does make things easier, but it also does mean that, unfortunately, we tend to rely more on technology and lose those essential skill sets over time, which I, you know, I'm a big believer we should never lose. The OCT may break down one day.
Yes. And actually, the reason why I thought we should repeat it is because I'd actually forgotten about that test. You know, thinking, oh, when did I last think about that test? It's probably thinking, actually, not long after I qualified, it's probably when I stopped thinking about it because we had OCT.
Yeah, and it's very satisfying to do because you've relied on your clinical skills rather than relying on pure technology. And not every practice will have OCT yet, but you don't need it.
And of course, you have still got the AMSLA grid.
Indeed. So critically, ask the patient to look at that black dot in the centre. Can they see it? Or does it disappear when they look at it? And the larger the hole, the greater the chance they will see a scotoma. The smaller the hole, they may not see a scotoma yet. So that's very useful. But remember, the key thing here is that distortion, it just localises symptoms to the macula. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you what the condition is. And again, that is down to good clinical examination in a dilated fundus and using OCT imaging if you have that available.
Yes. So if we do identify that a patient has a full thickness macular hole, optometrists do really want to know how quickly we should be referring these patients. Is it routine or urgent? How do we know what to do?
So if it's a full thickness macular hole, it's easy. You refer the patient. So I think we should break this down into different categories: routine, urgent, and an emergency. Please don't send them to your A&E or your acute referral service that day, right? You'll just upset a lot of people, including the patient and including your local ophthalmologist. So please don't send that. No one's going to operate that day. No one's going to operate the next day, okay? But do refer them urgently. And the reason for that is full-thickness macular holes are a time-critical and time-sensitive condition in which surgery performed as soon as possible is highly desirable. So we know that with every month of delay from presentation to surgery, the patient loses one less letter on the chart in terms of your best final outcome. So the chances of closure reduce over time, because over time the hole gets bigger, typically. So if you refer them through an urgent pathway, the vitreoretinal surgeon can pick that up. They know it's a macular hole, and hopefully they'll have special provisions in their clinics to accommodate macular holes sooner rather than later. For most macular holes, I do my best to try and see them within a couple of months if I can, and then to list them for surgery as soon as I can. But it's unlikely they'll have their surgery within 2 months, you know, even from the point of listing, because many of my patients have macular holes.
In the community, if we're aware that waiting lists are very long, at what point do we say to the patient, actually, yes, I think you should think about going privately?
So I think the key thing is to explain to the patients, with macular holes, the earlier we can operate, the better. This is a time-critical condition. And private surgery will generally always be quicker than the NHS. I think it's important to always offer the patient all available options. You know, for many patients, it will not be an option, and that's fine. Then you have no choice but to refer to the NHS. But it's up to the patient to decide.
And if the patient knows about the options, they can then make an informed decision as to what is best for their circumstances. If you have a patient that has quite a small full thickness macular hole, is it ever worth just monitoring that? Because do they ever self-resolve?
A small percentage do, but the majority of patients have small macular holes that are going to progress. And it's most unlikely they'll have surgery within a couple of months. But what that does do is provide an opportunity for monitoring. So if it's still there, then it's unlikely to resolve. And then they're already on the waiting list. And we've been able to offer surgery as soon as possible. So by the time they end up getting seen within hospital eye services, they will generally have had a period of monitoring. And springboarding off that is the important concept of please provide a detailed referral, if you can, of the OCT findings. Remember, they're just images and they won't necessarily show the dimensions. So do please try to categorize that macular hole like I've shown, which is there VMT or not? What's the size of the hole? And was there any particular cause, like trauma, etc., which is usually pretty rare. So if you can certainly at least put down the presence or absence of VMT and also the size of the hole, the minimum linear diameter, that generally will help us work out which trajectory is this patient going on, which could influence our decision making.
And just very briefly, because we've mentioned it in passing, what is a pseudo hole? Sounds like a silly question.
Pseudo hole is something that looks like a hole on clinical examination. So this terminology comes from the days of pre-OCT, right? So in the presence of OCT, we'd never call it a hole because it isn't. But on clinical examination, it looks like one. So this is where generally there's the presence of an epiretinal membrane. The epiretinal membrane is contracting in a kind of almost centripetal fashion so that what it's doing is it's causing heaping up of those foveal margins. So it's verticalizing them. There's absolutely no loss of retinal tissue, which is a really important point. And yes, you can get ERMs with a full thickness macular hole. But if you do your Watzke-Allen test, you'll see no break.
And that takes us very nicely, Cam, into epiretinal membranes. You know, why do epiretinal membranes form?
A very good point, and leads on very nicely to referral patterns. So the vast majority of epiretinal membranes we used to call idiopathic. So idiopathic means we've looked at all causes, couldn't find a cause, and therefore it's idiopathic. It's essentially unknown. We know that in order to develop an epiretinal membrane, i.e. on the surface of the internal limiting membrane, there needs to be space. So if someone has a fully attached vitreous, then generally it's difficult for an epiretinal membrane to form because there isn't that space. So there needs to be some separation. We think what happens is that as the vitreous separates, it causes some defects within the ILM and in the inner retina that then allows proliferation of some of the retinal cells, glial tissue and other cells, to kind of form together and then grow on that internal limiting membrane. We know that the ILM is a scaffold that is generally needed for these aberrant cells to grow on. And then these patients develop epiretinal membranes. But what we don't know is why do some people with no risk factors or other causes develop it and others don't? But idiopathic means you've excluded other causes. And important other causes are peripheral vitreoretinal conditions like retinal breaks, which may be acute or chronic, retinal detachments, inflammation, diabetes, even some tumors in the retinal periphery can cause the growth of epiretinal membranes, previous surgery. You know, there's all these other conditions. So in order to say that something is idiopathic, by definition, you have to have excluded the known causes.
So then, what is the urgency of referral for epirectal membranes?
It depends, is it idiopathic or not? So the first time a patient presents, if you see an ERM, the correct thing to do, really, is to dilate the patient and just make sure there's nothing else causing that. So it's important to, at least on the first occasion, dilate the patient, and then you've done it. You can say there's no secondary causes causing this epirectal membrane. It is therefore classed as idiopathic. You do really need to do a proper dilated 360 examination of that fundus at least once, which would then influence your referral urgency. If you see a break in the retina, then clearly, regardless of epiretinal membrane symptoms or not, you're going to refer them for the tear, right?
Yeah.
Or for a chronic retinal detachment.
Yes.
The ERM itself may be asymptomatic. So that's why it's important to exclude those secondary causes. You've got to find out what caused this in the first place.
And of course, we might be seeing epiretinal membranes now more in practice because we are doing OCT more. The patient may not be symptomatic at all. So if we've done a dilated examination and we can't find a secondary cause and the patient is asymptomatic, we don't need to refer that patient, do we? We can just monitor them over time and make sure that it remains stable.
Remember, most epiretinal membranes will be idiopathic. They can occur in up to 10-15% of the population. And we're not going to refer all those numbers of people to the VR department just because it's an ERM. We tend to refer them if they're symptomatic or if they've got these other causes.
So, Cam, just finally, another pathology that we see a lot of in practice is cataract. So if an optometrist knows a patient has an epiretinal membrane, perhaps they've done an OCT as part of their assessment, and the patient's also got a cataract that needs referring, do you think that optometrist should refer to a trust hospital where they could be provided with combined VR surgery or to an independent cataract service provider?
So, Michelle, this is another example where your clinical skills are paramount in terms of deciding what to do with this patient, because epiretinal membranes are very common, but very few of them actually need to be operated on. So if you scan a cataract patient, if you do an OCT, there's a reasonable chance you may find an epiretinal membrane, as we said. So here, it's about using your clinical skills, taking a good history and good clinical examination, and then deciding what overall is going on with this eye. So if you have a patient with a clear visible membrane on clinical examination, you've excluded sinister causes such as retinal tears, etc., and you are confident this is just a primary or idiopathic epiretinal membrane, and the membrane looks significant on the OCT scan or on clinical examination, then do an AMSA test and ask the patient about their symptoms. Are they just describing symptoms that would be purely ascribable to cataract, i.e. cloudy vision, glare, halos, etc.? Or are they also describing distortion in addition to the symptoms of the cataract, or a smudge in the center of their vision? So if they are, and if you can demonstrate any of this on an AMSA chart, then this would be one of those patients where you can be more confident that the symptoms in that eye are ascribable both to cataract and to the epiretinal membrane, in which case it makes far more sense that they're referred to a vitreoretinal unit where we can treat the cataract and the epiretinal membrane at the same time.
That makes perfect sense, because a significant epiretinal membrane can limit the success of cataract surgery, can't it?
The worry there is if you remove the cataract and the epiretinal membrane is significant, number one, that patient is at greater risk of postoperative cystoid macular edema. Number two, you may well further worsen any symptoms of distortion, because taking out the cataract will unmask the symptoms of distortion even more. It makes everything clearer, including whatever the patient may not want to see, i.e. distortion. The other thing to do, and this is actually highlighted by a patient I saw only yesterday in my clinic, a patient who was referred with bilateral cataracts, was look at the visual acuity and look at the severity of the cataract in each eye. So this patient was 6/18 in the right eye, 6/9 in the left, and referred for cataract surgery. However, when you look at the cataracts, clinical dilated examination, they were equal in both eyes, which therefore suggests maybe there's something else going on. And when I looked at the fundus and did an OCT scan, there's a visible grade 3 epiretinal membrane. So it's about using the entire skill set, take a good history, do a good bilateral clinical examination, look at the scans, ask the patients about symptoms of both cataract and epiretinal membrane or other pathologies such as macular holes, etc. And that should tell you
whether this should just go to a pure cataract unit or to a specialist vitreoretinal unit.
And in cases where there is only a mild epiretinal membrane and someone does have a cataract, is there any risk of that mild epiretinal membrane progressing with cataract surgery? And do you think we should be informing patients of that before we refer them?
There is that risk, and the risk is small. But would it change the outcome? Because if the patient is symptomatic of cataract, and we know the cataracts only get worse, then the patient will still elect for surgery. It's just one of those risks associated with it. The epiretinal membrane is unlikely to go away. The cataract is very likely to progress. So at some point, they're going to have to cross that road anyway and elect for cataract surgery and accept that there's a small chance that the epiretinal membrane will progress.
And you mentioned that with an epiretinal membrane, there's an increased risk of cystoid macular edema postoperatively. Is that something that optometrists should be looking out for when they do their community four-week checks? If they know they've referred a patient with a mild epiretinal membrane and the patient's come back for that community check 4 weeks after surgery, is that something that they should be very mindful of?
Absolutely. And if we know that the patient has an epiretinal membrane, and if you do have access to OCT imaging, that always would be a gold standard in terms of excluding macular edema in these patients. If you don't have an OCT, look at the visual acuity. If the visual acuity is very good and expected, by that we mean best corrected visual acuity, then you can be reassured that even if there is any macular edema, that it's subclinical and not visually relevant and probably then doesn't need treating. But if you do have less than expected best corrected visual acuity and you have access to an OCT, then please do the OCT. And if you are IP, you could probably treat the macular edema yourself. And if not, then do please let the hospital eye services know. My own practice for these patients, if they have an epiretinal membrane that doesn't require surgery or previous history of epiretinal membrane surgery, I tend to put them on a prolonged course of topical steroids and topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to help prevent that, because there is a definite increased risk of CMO in these patients. And remember, some of these patients may be diabetic. That may be the cause of their ERM, in which case they're going to have an increased risk as well. So multiple reasons.
So Ken, we've covered a lot of ground this morning, but what are your take-home messages?
We'll perhaps break this down into the different conditions. So with macular holes, the key message here is refer as soon as possible. And please do try to measure the hole. If they have symptomatic vitreomacular traction, again, please refer that. Use your clinical skills. Not everyone with VMT needs referring. Look at the whole patient, not just the OCT scan. With epiretinal membranes, remember something is only idiopathic if you've excluded all secondary causes. So if it's the first time you're seeing a patient with an epiretinal membrane, it's the first time it's being diagnosed, the gold standard and what you really should do is do dilate the patient and exclude other causes. You know, you can be satisfied that that's a primary epiretinal membrane and they either don't need referring or they need referring routinely. But it wouldn't be the case if you find something in the periphery causing it, such as a retinal tear. And then in terms of dual pathology, such as epiretinal membranes and cataract, it boils down to the same theme, which is use your clinical skills. Remember, they can have other things also causing their reduced vision, such as macular holes, ERMs, AMD, etc., which again highlights the importance of a dilated examination for anyone that you're going to consider referring for cataract surgery.
That's great, Cam. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. If you've got a topic in mind that you'd like us to cover, you can email us on podcast@dockets.info or use LinkedIn to send us a message. There's a link in the podcast description. Remember that if you go on to complete the short exercise on our website, you can gain one CPD point covering professionalism and clinical practice. We'll be back again next month, so be sure to hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. That's all from us this month. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.